Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Jim Steinmeier, author of Charles Fort, the man who invented the supernatural. Also, if you want to share perhaps your supernatural stories with us, and we'll compare it with what Charles Fort has done in his career. So we'll do all that next on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, when you were putting together the Charles Fort book, what did you like the most about it as you were doing your work and research?
I really was attracted to, as I said, first the phenomenon and then second, him personally and his take on all of it. And I think it was just such an enlightened way of looking at kind of our world and the oddities in the world. He has brilliant, simple outlooks on all of this. And he certainly recognized that people thought he was odd for obsessing over these facts. But, I mean, one of his famous quotes in Lowe is when he talks about these phenomena and these kind of strange, odd phenomena that we encounter, is he said, you know, one measures a circle starting anywhere. And that these odd little facts are part of our world just as significant as any other part, as any other kind of range of science or any other kind of philosophy. And although they've been discarded, there's something that we should be paying attention to. And I think his kind of fairness in dealing with all of this is always been fascinating to me. The way his outlook, even though he came from a very troubled life, the way he approached all these subjects and kind of loved the world and loved all of these strange facts, even the ones that terrified him, was really noble.
Was he a nice guy?
I think he was a very sweet guy. That's what we hear from the people who knew him. Yes, very shy. The amazing story of Dreiser is Dreiser knew him for decades, and they were very good friends. They write about their dear friendship. And when Fort died, Dreiser wrote that he might have met him 20 times, which is a little less than once a year.
Yeah,
and they lived in the same city.
That is amazing.
He just they wrote letters up and back. Didn't correspond by phone, through letters up and back in New York, and he saw him occasionally. But people, although he was shy, he had a wonderful sense of humor, and people liked being around him.
Okay, let's go to some calls. Let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio, east of the Rockies. Hey, Russ, it's your turn.
Yeah, George, how you doing tonight?
Okay, Russell.
Hey, I haven't talked to you in a couple of years, but I was wanting to ask Jim. Jim, you were talking about different people that were influenced by Charles Fort, and I know that George mentioned the One Step Beyond. And I thought, what about Rod Serling with Twilight Zone and
good point.
Radio program X-10 and maybe even Gene Roddenberry? What's your comment on that?
Fort absolutely influenced a particular range of science fiction stories that are absolutely Fortian. And the authors of them in the 50s attributed them directly to Fort. I don't know about Roddenberry. I think that might fall a little beyond the sort of oddities that he discussed, although in the sense that Fort led to classic science fiction stories that are still famous today, I think it's fair to say that, you know, he had an enormous influence on science fiction because all of this work entered that genre and was used for plots. So even though there was a specific group of Fortian stories, I think it's safe to say that someone like Gene Roddenberry must have been influenced by it because he would have been influenced by those stories.
What about the Ray Bradbury? We'd have to check in with Ray and ask him.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, all of these things are so close to science fiction, and people were commenting that at the time, that 50s science fiction was very heavily influenced by it because that was just the generation before, and these books were still current.
What did he think about evil and demons?
He stays away from. He's very careful to stay away from religion. He's certainly is not a believer, but we see that in his letters, and it comes through in his writing as well. But he just doesn't put, as he says, biblical stories into his. He doesn't use those as examples because he says they fall outside of the history. They fall outside of his range of history. One of the comments he makes is he said, I'm inclined to believe in miracles, basically, but I also think that there would have been the same miracles if the world had been inhabited by atheists.
Interesting.
So, you know, once again, there's Fort turning you on your ear. You know, just as you start to hear the word miracle, you know, he pulls the rug out. So I think he would not attribute any of those things to grand forces like evil or goodness or religion or the devil. Instead, he thinks that that's all part of our world.
We go to Redding, California now, west of the Rockies. Joe, you're up. Hey, Joe.
Hey, George. Good to talk to you.
You too, Joe.
I'm lucky to get through here. I hope this subject fits in. It's like a little supernatural true life story here.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I was climbing Mount Shasta probably 30 years ago with a friend of mine. And are you there?
Yep.
Okay. And anyhow, I was like 15, 16 years old, totally inexperienced climber. I was climbing with a guy about 10 or 15 years older than me, trying to make this quick. We totally went the wrong way. Climbed to the top of the ski lift was not the way to go. Ended up climbing up over a ridge and ended up on the right path. And we ended up in a place called Lake Helen, where it's not a lake. It's just an area called Lake Helen on the mountain where all these really cool rock formations, somebody must have taken a really long time to build these little circles that were about 4 feet tall. Some were bigger than others. We picked one about the size that I would say four people could lay down in, you know, at night with our sleeping bags. In any event, the first thing is there was no wind at all. You know how they speed up the clouds on the shows where you see clouds speeded up?
Yep.
Okay, we were looking at the peak of the mountain, and that's exactly how it looked like. The clouds were churning like you can't believe. There was absolutely no wind. Really weird. Anyhow, we're getting kind of, I don't know, should we go up there or, you know, what? So we decided to camp the night. Out of nowhere came this person. We were thinking about going back down, but we decided to camp the night. This person came from nowhere.
Just popped up. He showed up at your camp.
Just showed up. I mean, we are at this place, and I'm all wide-eyed and looking around. It was really quite an experience, you know, so I was aware of everything going on, the clouds. Guy shows up. Okay, he's hungry. He wants something to eat. And we're like, where did you come from? He's like, oh, I just came from out of the inside of the mountain. And we're like, what? You know, no way. We're just looking at each other. And the guy seemed harmless enough. He was hungry. And we had our little burner going. And so we fixed our little lentils and our little, you know, freeze-dried foods, you know, had our little dinner, and he sat and told us all these stories. And meanwhile, there's no wind. These clouds are churning. He's talking about coming out of the mountain and what he had just experienced inside the mountain, angels, lights, all these things. And we were, okay. And he's like, are you guys going to stay here tonight? And I'm like, we're like, well, yeah. And he's like, And out of nowhere, he pulls this big rock. I would say you'd have to get your whole hand, you know, would go about halfway around it. It was blue, like turquoise. It was a rock like I'd never seen before, not like any of the rocks laying around. We're like, where'd you get that? He said, I got it from inside the mountain. And he said, I have to go now, but I'm going to leave this rock right here and kind of set it on top of this circle rock formation that we were camping in. He goes, I'm going to leave this right here, and it's going to protect you tonight. And we're like, oh, okay.
Kind of nice to hear, right?
Right, yeah. It was just strange. I mean, you could have a whole show with me on there, I'm telling you. But this is just one thing. Anyway, he stands up, puts the rock there, and me and my buddy look at each other, and we're like, this is okay. And then we looked back, and the guy was gone.
Just nowhere like that.
Quickly as he popped in. He was gone. The rock was there. And, I mean, we're on Mount Shasta. There's, like, nowhere to run and hide, okay? There's just no trees, no anything. We're on the mountain. It's like nothing. I mean, you know, there's nowhere he could go duck or anything.
And I assume that rock protected you, huh?
Yeah. Listen to this. Well, the next day, we woke up, and, I mean, I won't even go into everything I saw that
night. Don't have time for that.
Anyway, the next day we got up in the morning. The rock was gone. We made our trek up the mountain, came back down. Everything was safe. The very next day, the exact same spot where we slept, there was a massive rock slide at like 3:30 in the morning and killed three people.
Oh, would have wiped you guys out.
Yep.
All right. So let me ask you, Jimmy, would Charles Fort use that story?
Well, it's really interesting. It's interesting because one of the things, several subjects that interest him that that don't always make it into the modern accounts are a fascination with geological things, geological oddities, and meteorological oddities that are also tied together often. He links a lot of things that don't belong together, like earthquakes and sounds from the skies and flashes of light from the skies, and things that don't seem to be linked. And he points out how they are linked, how volcanoes are linked to other phenomena, even though it doesn't seem to make any sense. And so a lot of his research, because it came out of scientific journals, ties to natural phenomena like this. Not necessarily a man with a rock, but certainly when you talk about clouds or an odd place in the earth where these things are experienced, those are things that fascinated him.
How would he have handled the Mothman stories in John Keel?
That's a really interesting story. John Keel was a Fortean and was a follower of Fort. In fact, wrote a book about Fort, wrote a book based in Fortean philosophy called Disneyland of the Gods. And a lot of the interest of those subjects for John Keel came out of Fort. The interesting thing about Fort is that he was very, very careful about human experience, human testimony. It certainly shows up in his books, but he's just when you think that, he's going to be writing a lot about spiritualism. No, he doesn't write about
spiritualism. He wanted eyewitness accounts, didn't he?
He wanted eyewitness accounts, and he wanted things that were phenomena. Things that were, that were tied to phenomena, as opposed to someone saying, I had an experience. Yeah. I remember this. I had a vision. Again, he didn't talk about his own visions. He didn't talk about his own experience with ghosts. He didn't think that was significant.
Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. First time caller, Mobius. Go ahead, Mobius.
How's it going today, George?
Okay, sir.
I would just like to tell you about an experience that I had.
Sure thing.
Taking a performance-enhancing, I guess you could say, substance, and it enabled me to focus on the compression and decompression of my balance and imbalance to a frequency that enables you to catch up with the frame rate of higher-dimensional beings, I guess you could say.
Put you in another state of mind, no doubt.
Yes, mm-hmm. But it's certainly replicatable through sobriety.
Were these experiences real or were they imagined?
Well, there's a good test. You can question everything, try to make anything around you mimic something that you could control. And if it cannot, then it almost seems like you're in the realm of something that has a definite cognition.
Jim, did Charles Fort deal with other dimensions?
It's very interesting. Early in his writing career, he went to elaborate pains to visualize elements and was involved in a lot of experiments that I think people will recognize today as kind of self-hypnosis, where he would take a piece of fabric that had like smudged lines on it, from lamp black. And then he would focus on it until he would start to, fall out of focus, and then he would imagine pictures coming to himself in it. He used a lot of examples like that to try and get to the point where he could visualize stories and characters, and he wanted the inspiration in that form. What's interesting is that he drank beer. He and his wife loved beer, and they were terrified by Prohibition because they couldn't get beer from their beer man. But other than that, we don't think he ever took any kind of drug through his life at all. In fact, when he was on his deathbed, Dreiser...
They think he died of leukemia, right?
They think he died of leukemia, and Dreiser pleaded with him to take some sort of drug to just ease the pain. And when Fort finally took it, days before he died, he couldn't believe how pleasurable it was. I mean, he couldn't believe that there was something like that he hadn't been using. So he avoided all of that, but he was involved in experiments, in mind experiments like that early in his writing career.
Was he was he a friend of the Good Old Boy Network?
Uh, I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, you know, was he like members of clubs and things like that?
No.
None of that. Kind of a recluse.
When he wouldn't join the Fortean organization, he said, you know, neither would I become an elk.
Yeah. All right.
He just didn't want any part of that.
No. Next up, we go to Wendy in St. Louis, east of the Rockies. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. Good
morning to you too.
I've got a husband who's very skeptical about things. Every once in a while, you know, I get premonitions, stuff like this. But being a truck driver, whenever my truck is about ready to, you know, honk out on me or whatever, I get this real strong smell of old spice cologne, which my dad used to wear, you know, when he was alive. And two of the times when I smelled it, first time, I smelled it real strong. I pulled over to the side of the road, and I checked my truck out, and I went, you know, to move forward. The drive shaft fell out of it.
Oh.
The second time, I smelled the old spice cologne again, and I started hearing a noise in the front of the truck. Well, I turned around and I looked at it, you know, trying to figure out what it was. Nothing, but, you know, I couldn't find nothing. And I called the company up and they said, take it to the nearest shop and look at it. Well, I did. And the guy says, well, I'm surprised you got this far because the front wheel wheel hub was completely disintegrated. They said if I wouldn't went any farther, I would have either killed myself or killed somebody else if the wheel wouldn't came off.
Oh, my. So dad's been following you, huh?
My dad's following me, and just the other day it happened again. I, you know, smelled this old spice cologne, and my husband goes, what's that smell? And I said, my dad. I go, I smelled his old spice cologne. And he goes, oh, come on, don't say that crap, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I go, babe, something's going on. Well, I went downstairs to check the laundry, and I seen some smoke coming out of my daughter's room in the basement, and she's got one of those heaters, you know, that's got that oil in it.
Oh, yeah.
It had tipped over, and it was smoke.
You would have lost the house, Wendy. It would have been gone. Charles Fort would have used that story, Jim.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting that his last book, Wild Talents, is about people with unusual abilities. And he does talk about a lot of the things that we talk about today, like poltergeists. And he talks a little bit about spiritualism. But also in there are things like spontaneous human combustion, which was kind of the first time the public had heard about those stories.
He started all these stories. You know what?
He really did. He really, the roots of so many of the things that we classify today, that we talk about, are just within the pages of those, within the covers of those books. And absolutely, those kind of oddities, those sort of premonitions, I think that certainly towards the end of his life, I mean, he kind of was focusing on more personal stories like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you noticed his writing got better as he got older?
His writing, you saw him more in his writing. I think he dropped the veil a little more in the last two books.
Got involved more with what
he wrote. You started to know who he was. He became a little less self-conscious. He wasn't necessarily posing behind theories necessarily. Every once in a while in the first books, you'll encounter a paragraph that, you know, says, we believe that the, you know, scientific community, to wit, you know, our opponents will find. And, you know, you say, who's writing this? It sounds like some kind of academic board. And it's clearly a guy kind of trying to build himself up to a status.
Let's come back and we'll take final phone calls with you, Jim Steinmeier, author of Charles Fort, The Man Who Invented the Supernatural. Well, next hour with our floating format, Jeffrey Smith joins us as we talk about genetically modified foods. But when we come back, we'll take final phone calls with Jim Steinmeier, all about Charles Fort, the man who invented the supernatural, and some of your supernatural stories. It seemed like Charles Fort liked to make a mockery of some of the scientists of his era.
Absolutely.
How come?
I think that he wanted to knock everything down to the same size. I think that part of the technique of elevating these oddities to a certain status was also making the point that this information is no more valid than the information that's been selected and put in front of you. And so he wanted to point out that there are arbitrary decisions being made by scientists, or arbitrary decisions as to what's significant. He was one of the first people to question Darwinism. Not because, of course, he was a fundamentalist in any way. I mean, quite the opposite. But he questioned the tautology of it, you know, of Spencer's notion of the survival of the fittest, you know, and kind of said, well, the only way you tell if something's fit is because it survives. And so, you know, how do you use that as some sort of selective theory? And so he looked at science, and he was quite interesting, some of the observations he made.
Okay, to the phones we go. Let's go to Greenville, South Carolina. Alexander, you're up with us. Hello there. Good morning.
Yeah, hello, George Norrie. You wanted to know about Charles Fort. I was interested in him, and I came into communication with him in the book, the Book of the Dam. I read about it in 1952, and then I became interested in the UFOs. But then the thing was, he was born. He died on March 24th, 1932.
That's right.
And he died somewhere on Long Island, I believe. He either Valley Stream or Franklin Square.
He died in the Bronx.
Oh, he died in the Bronx.
He died in the Bronx, nearby. Nearby, yeah.
Because I was born on March 24th, 1932.
Really?
Yeah. And then I became involved in UFO activity in 1952. And ever since, I've had, like, experiences with them. They used to stay around. They used to be all over Long Island and all over New York. And then when I got, and then when I went on a radio, a TV show in New York, which was the Jack Parr show on NBC, and the person that was in as the MC was Jonathan Winters. And I appeared on the Les Crane show in '64, and the UFOs appeared. Oh, there was three contactees on the show with me, and then there was the ABC science editor and Les Crane. And Les Crane, when he went to California, he had a show on UFOs. He remembered me because I used to work in a button factory on Long Island, and I used to make buttons, military and civilian. And when I went out at night, I used to see UFOs, and the only one I saw was the one on the ground. It was like two pie plates on top of each other, an egg-shaped dome in the middle. It carried red and blue navigational lights. It had a crew of three little guys about 3 feet tall.
The little grays, Jim?
No, I saw them as green uniforms and blue caps, and they had an insignia on the side of the craft, which was like a half moon with a V and a line running through it like an arrow, and then an arrow underneath. Just like the one that Lonnie Samora saw in 1958.
In Socorro, New Mexico.
In Socorro, New Mexico.
Wow.
And I saw that in 52.
Alexander, I want to take your phone number. Tom, get his number, because I want to talk to you about some other things and get some more of that. So those stories, did Fort write on individual UFO stories?
No, he wrote in accounts. He wrote in accounts that were in newspapers and in scientific journals of crafts in the air that were absolute, you know, individual sightings. But you have to understand that at that time, by the 30s, those were few and far between. They certainly startled people. Reviews often commented on these stories of crafts in the sky. What's interesting to me is that a generation later, when UFOs were sighted and when this began, you know, when this began in the 50s, with a few distinct episodes, and then it mushroomed. What happened was is that the writers and the researchers, they went back exactly one generation, basically 20 years, and boom, there were Fort's books. And of course, just by going through them, they had the prehistory of it. They had the tie, you know, in other words, kind of all of the legwork had been done. And as soon as this became a modern movement, it became an established movement, because of what Fort had done before.
Interesting. Linwood, Washington, west of the Rockies. Micah, it's your turn.
Hey, hi, George Norrie.
Hey, Micah.
I just was kind of interested on what Fort would have thought of the cryptozoology stuff, say, like Bigfoot and things like that.
Did he get into Bigfoot at all?
No. It's very interesting, just as some topics are absolutely there and are recognizable as modern. a couple things like that. Bigfoot, the abominable snowman, you know, the Yeti, those don't make that in. Those stories aren't yet in the common accounts, and he didn't pick up on those. He writes, there are a few early cryptozoology stories about mysterious creatures that are there are accounts of, and, you know, returns of them in specific areas. But there's nothing as recognizable as the stories today. And once again, it's a kind of groundwork of it. It's a sort of legacy that he establishes before the popular accounts and the most witnessed accounts then get into the literature.
Okay, thanks, Mike. I appreciate you being part of the program. We go to Rose in Thousand Oaks, first-time caller. Rose, hi.
Hi, George. How are you?
Okay.
My girlfriend and I were backpacking through the UK, and we made a stop in Edinburgh, Scotland, which is known to be one of the most haunted cities in the world.
That's a very spooky place, yes.
Yes, very much so. And being that we were in the spookiest place, one of the spookiest places in the world, we decided to take a couple ghost tours. And one of these ghost tours had claimed that there was a famous poltergeist that has inflicted all kinds of stuff on tourists. So we're like, yeah, of course we're going to do this one. And so we do it, and it takes place in the Blackfriars Cemetery. And at the end of the cemetery, there's a little area that's been closed off for several years, and then this ghost tour company got the rights and the keys, basically, to bring people through there. And it's called the Covenanter's Garden, and it's infamous for a lot of strange activities, one being the old guard that used to work there, Mackenzie, is now occupying one of the spaces in there and is inflicting pain on people who come into his space. And so we go into this one space. We're only allowed to be in there for literally 10 minutes because I guess after 10 minutes there's too much energy and activity that rouses the poltergeist. So, and they give us kind of like a little warning, you know, the last person out, you know, be careful kind of thing. So my girlfriend and I wait to be the last person out, people out.
That's pretty bold.
And, yeah, well, we were really hoping to get something here. You
sure.
Know? And we leave. I step out first, and then she steps out, and all of a sudden I look back, and she's limping. And I'm like, hey, what's wrong, you know? And she's like, I don't know, something doesn't feel right. She lifts up her jeans, pant leg, and then I see that through her sock is a blood-soaked wound. Mind you, she's wearing long jeans, and her socks, you know, hadn't been ripped. Her jeans hadn't been torn or anything. But she has a nice little gash right across her Achilles tendon. And we took a look back at where we had stepped out of. There were no nails or, you know, any kind of protruding objects that could have caught her somehow without tearing her jeans. But we still, to this day, cannot quite explain it. And several other spooky things happened that followed that trip, but it's made me a believer where I was not one before.
That would have been a one step beyonder, Jim.
You know what? That goes directly into wild talents. That's exactly the kind of thing that kind of, you know, people with very strange injuries and strange accidents like that. That just goes right into the kind of classic Fort genre. Yeah.
Where did you get the old pictures of Fort and his family?
The Fort and his family pictures were from archives. They ended up in family archives and the Damon Knight Collection, who gathered together some of the Fort archives when he was doing his biography. And other photos appear at they're in the Theodore Dreiser archives. Dreiser has archives in several libraries. The largest collection is the University of Pennsylvania. That has Dreiser letters, and there were a number of the photographs that were directly from there.
You know what's fascinating in terms of times have changed? You know, like here in Los Angeles or St. Louis or New York, in most cases when people are going out now, they're going out pretty casually. They're wearing jeans and a shirt or a little jacket or something like that. In the old days, everybody was in these thick tweed suits all the time.
Yeah.
Guys were. Women dressed up, hats. Whenever they went out. Nobody went out casually in those days.
No, I think that was the uniform for going out, actually.
Yeah.
You know, you put on a suit and
top hat and everything.
Yeah. And Ford has stories about, as a child, you know, getting cheap suits as a child, you know, which disappointed him. I mean, you know, kind of crummy clothes and being disappointed with that. But, you know, because you would wear it day after day after day.
And it'll wear out.
Absolutely.
Janesville, Wisconsin. Paula, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Paula.
Hi, George.
Hey.
I have an experience for you. I've got several, actually.
Give me one.
No time.
Give me one.
Yeah, I know.
Tonight.
I was coming out of a drugstore in my city, West Milwaukee Street in Jackson.
All right.
One night, about 6 or 7 o'clock, and everything started turning really weird, unnatural, like stage props.
What do you mean? Like what?
Absolute black and white, and really dark, sickness, black sky. And
you mean like buildings would be black and white to you and everything?
Yes.
That's weird. What was happening to you?
Well, you know, I don't know how to classify it. It either could be something like the show you had on last night, or it could be the beginning of psychic abilities.
And then when did things pop back to normal again?
Oh, in a few minutes.
Strange. See, sometimes... Now, here's another question, Jim. What about medical conditions of people at the time? And did Ford ever try to analyze that, or was he just going for the core stories? Like in her case, maybe something was happening to her eyesight.
Absolutely, yeah. Again, I think this is why for kind of many of his books, he stayed away from sort of personal stories, and he expressed his skepticism just because he says he can't analyze elements like that. But in the last book, he does talk about personal stories, and he analyzes them. He reasons through different explanations, different possible explanations. Obviously, he favors things that are extraordinary in a way that you can't really question the motive. But he talks about poltergeists. He talks about the possibility of you know, people, you know, little girls that are kind of doing this as a prank, and, you know, what the evidence of that was. And he speculates about that. He tries to be very, very even-handed. What's interesting, again, to me about his literature is that he really analyzes it and gives you a rational discussion of it. It isn't about someone just looking for these stories and kind of saying, well, by editing it like this and exaggerating this a little bit, I can make the story better, which is, of course, what many authors, as an author myself, I have to tell you, you know, that's often what you end up doing. You make the story as good as you can, because that's what makes it go into into print. But I think what's amazing about him was really how fair he was about it. I know stories he just left out after he researched them because they weren't right. They didn't pan out. He didn't like the evidence that he found. So I think he was very fair about that.
Was this an easy book to write for you?
Not necessarily. It was a tremendous amount to read. It was a tremendous amount to read and study and understand, because there was so much literature.
And then you had to compress it, didn't you?
Yeah, it's because it's a tiny little biography. I mean, it's a simple little biography when it all ends up. But there was a lot of, you know, not only his stories and his books, but the books of all the people around him, like Dreiser. There was a lot of literature, because it's kind of a literary story at the time, and the people involved in it were all writers. So in that level, it took a while, and the archives were all around the country, the sources of this material, the Dreiser materials and Fort materials.
Did he only cover stories that were published in, like, newspapers and periodicals, or would he actually just interview some people?
He because of his kind of hermit-like existence, you know, and also the fact that he was, you know, in an apartment in London, or, you know, in an apartment in the Bronx. He didn't necessarily, you know, he didn't take trips to interview people, but he did correspond with people. He would search out people in an area, or he would write to a local newspaper and have them run a letter saying, 20 years ago, for example, you know, there's an account that this happened in this town. Does anyone know about this? Would you please contact the writer, Charles Ford? And he was very fair about that. He didn't necessarily do personal interviews, but he did seek the stories out. He used very few newspaper accounts. He was always accused of that, you know, oh, well, he just took a newspaper story and clipped it out.
Sure.
Many of his accounts are from scientific journals. Scientific American.
Without answers, of course, right?
Oh, of course, without answers. Yeah. No, it's accounts of phenomena that were recorded in literature, in British meteorological journals, French meteorological journals. You know, he takes accounts from the most authoritative places he can.
Let's go to Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. David, go ahead, David.
Hi. My story has to do with when I was in Arizona, and I was having a conversation with my brother in the living room at one point, and we were just talking, and the next thing I know, I just, like, look over to my left, and in the hallway, I just saw this circular dark object of some sort, and I didn't quite get a good look at it, but I saw it, like, stop for a second while it was crossing from one bedroom to the other, which was right across from the bedroom that it was in. And it just seemed to be like this circular object with like small like tentacle like things on it, but it was about the size of like a finger of like what it looked like. But it was like, it looked like it was two dimensional almost.
Hmm.
And it was very weird. I haven't seen anything like it before. I've heard you guys talk about shadow people, but this is something more along the lines of just like a shadow figure of some sort. And like, I saw it move from one end to the other room, and I didn't know what to think at first. And I looked at my brother. I'm like, I'm not even going to explain to you what I just saw. I didn't really know what to think of it at the time. And then the next day, I saw it again for the second time, and it came out from underneath the couch when I was getting up to answer the door because there was a knock on the door. And I go to open the door, and it's my friend who I've been like seen in a while, and like I was about to talk to her, and then right when I opened the door, I see it like come out from the corner of my eye where like the armrest of the couch is like facing the door, and it comes out from underneath the couch, and it makes like this noise that I hear, and the noise it made, it moves really, really quickly for me to like even like keep track of where it was moving. And then, like, it made this noise that was, like, a mixture between that of a hissing of a snake and, like, the hissing of a cat, like, intertwined.
And, you know, Fort would, I think, been fascinated by the fact that people are having these strange accounts, Jim.
Well, I'll tell you what is interesting about that is he has to speculate a number of times in his books about odd occurrences that are completely out of place. And when he did, he coined a word that we now know today, and that word was teleportation.
Perfect. Hey, thanks so much, Jim. Have a safe flight. The book, Charles Fort, The Man Who Invented the Supernatural. Up next, Jeffrey Smith joins us. We're talking about what India is not doing, and that is accepting some genetically modified foods. How does that affect you here? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.